तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। So I'd like to spend a little time this morning just talking about approaches to meditation. And many of you are probably were introduced to the practice of breath meditation, and maybe that's your main meditations, and perhaps other walking meditation. Feeling the sensations of the feet touching the floor. And those are very good meditations. Is it audible back there? Or should you turn? Does it need to be louder? Yeah, maybe we could turn it up a little bit. I don't know. Yeah. I'm getting into microphones. I used to shout everywhere, you know, but now I'm learning the joy of speaking through a microphone where you don't have to strain to get to the back of the rooms. Yes. Okay. So these are only two of many meditation techniques, and particularly the breath is a very subtle meditation and quite demanding. And you may have found it that way, but you may have thought, well, maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm just having trouble with this. But historically, if you read the commentaries and so forth, you find that the breath is thought to be very, very demanding indeed. And there were many other meditations that were simpler. You don't hear about many of these other meditations anymore. I don't know why that is, but there are other things which I think if I talk about, you will probably find that you have been, to some extent in your own ordinary experience, doing some of these things. And these are to do with what we would call the elements, element meditation. The elements of nature. That would be the sort of the English notion. When we talk, you know, the sort of British kind of expression of being out in the elements, going out into nature and feeling the wind against your skin, the rain, the temperature changes, the heat, the experience of the forest, of the earth under your feet, of different walking across rocks, of walking across earth, of walking down the beach, of seeing rivers flow and lakes and the ocean come in. And this is the elements. And it's interesting, the notion of element. When we're taught the elements in school or in university, it's usually the periodic table of the elements. It's very interesting, the difference, and this reflects the way our whole culture actually thinks and perceives. There's a great difference between the periodic table. Can you experience magnesium? Can you experience iron? I don't think you can. But I think you can experience solidity. I think you can experience touching something that's iron and feeling its weight and solidity. And what you're doing there is in a sense, experiencing the element of solidity, what we would call the earth element. Now you can tell that if you raise something that's made of iron, and it feels different than something that's made of oak. And something that's made of oak is very different than something made of pine. What is the difference? And we have a very direct intuitive difference. One feels more solid and substantial, stronger, harder, weightier, This is a direct experience of reality. All the ancient cultures, their language, all of them involve this appreciation or experience of earth, wind, fire, water. They talk about the universe being constructed of this, the world being constructed of this. And it's very interesting. We tend to think of that as a very primitive before the advances in seeing into substances. But actually that is the way we actually directly experience it. We can't experience through a microscope. We don't experience subatomic particles. We talk about them. We say things are made of them, but that's not what you experience. What do you experience? You experience solidity, something with resistance. You not even with the touch, but you can see it sometimes. When you look at when you're appreciating a building, how solid it is, you're looking at this, the solidity of a building appears through your eyes. You can even experience this through sounds, solid sounds, confident sounds. The person has a confident voice, a solidity in their voice, or so their personality is they're a solid person, a solid citizen. There's also an airy citizen, airhead, a person who's not solid. You are real categories. Basic categories of experiencing the world are these very direct, simple categories. Solidity, warmth. A person is warm, or they're cold. Even architecture is cold, or warm. Or music is warm. It's very, very useful to start asking yourself about these direct experiences. What does it feel like? What does it actually feel like to me? One of our problems is that we conceptualize a lot. We have a lot of language. English particularly is a very large language full of technical terms, and it's full of concepts. And concepts are just that. There's concepts, and then there's reality. And we're rarely taught the difference of this in school. We're not necessarily taught that. We get carried away by concepts and confused. And these are, of course, the menus or sketches or blueprints. These are not the building itself. So meditation, both serenity meditation and insight meditation, requires that you come back to the direct experience of reality, and that you begin to allow concepts to go back to being concepts, and direct experience to come back to being direct experience. Both are useful. Concepts are useful, but it's when we fail to remember that they are concepts, or that we're confused about the difference between the concept and the reality. So meditation, what is this meditation? I'm asking you to breathe, or pay attention to the fact that you're breathing. This is a very non-conceptual attempt. Pay attention to the fact that you're walking. Not even the fact that you're walking. Walking is a concept. Do you need to have some sort of concept of walking, or is just the experience of the foot touching the carpet, or the foot going onto the tile? What is that experience? Temperature change, texture change, solidity change. The surface of the tile is very hard, resistant. And you feel it, you know it directly, right through the foot. Interesting about feet itself, and it's very interesting to go barefoot. This is interesting about in a culture, like when I became a monastic, especially in Asia, you're not allowed to wear shoes outside the monastery. You must go barefoot through on alms round through the village, and it's very different. You have a lot of information gathering in the soles of your feet. I guess they must be designed for that. When you walk certain areas, and you actually experience the earth through your feet. I often wonder how, you know, the Aboriginals came through North America, they say 20,000, 30,000 years ago or so. Maybe it was, that's a sort of an archaeological, anthropological sort of description. The natives themselves say they were always here. What do you mean we came here 30,000 years? We're always here. We are, we're it. But they found the best spots. I noticed that wherever a city is now in Canada, it's on right on an Indian traditional territory. And how did that happen? Well, the Indians found the best, very best, most beautiful spots in the entire continent. And I was been meditating on they journeyed, they obviously moved. How did they experience this? How did they come to decide that this was it? I think half of the experience must have been through the soles of their feet. The earth, as you walked across it, your it felt good. This area feels good. This area, how do you, through your direct perception of the skin, you know, the warmth here, it's warmer here. The openness, the feel, it's the direct experience of the elements that says this is good. And this is the direct reality. Sometimes, it's very interesting that in modern times, cities are sometimes designed through concepts and they're placed in bad places. Because without the architect doesn't walk barefoot through the countryside first. He should do that. He should close his eyes and walk barefoot across the field. Is this the place? Is this the place? He must go out there without his shirt on. I gotta get an architect to do this. I think I'm gonna start a whole school of architecture around this. Naked architects. They have to walk through the countryside and feel it and smell it. And this is actually our way, the way we, a much more concrete, direct way. And that is the way because we're going to end up living there. And that is the way we're going to actually perceive it. It's very interesting, the two different concepts. So this is a grounding. And this is what the Buddha is, why he gives out these meditation topics. Says, you know, you have to come in contact with reality, and much of your difficulties and problems are not real. And why do you have them? It's because you're not in touch with reality. So how do you, these are exercises for getting in touch with reality. I think I'm going to start a new school of psychotherapy as well. Exercise for getting in touch with, well, we already have a school of psychotherapy. This is, first of all, get in touch with reality. This is revealing in language. Start paying attention. What does it feel like? What does reality feel like? Is it hard? Is it watery? Is it warm? And when you start paying attention to this, it's a very different experience. Because where do you experience warmth? Where do you experience solidity of the earth? Where do you experience the breeze on your face? Where in time? Where is that? There's only one place. You can never experience it any other place. And that is now, in the present moment. If you think about it, you create the future in thought. The future doesn't, you can't feel the future. You can't come to experience the future directly or the past directly. You can only manufacture these things as concepts in the mind. But problem is, we do definitely get them confused with reality. We do not separate it out from reality. The Buddha is saying, just pay attention to what it is you actually do during the day. You have a concept, perhaps, of the complexity of your life. But what do you do? So he's saying, in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutta, he's saying, the monk, when walking forward, knows he's walking forward. When stretching out his arm, he knows he's stretching out his arm. When turning around, he knows he is turning around. When drinking, when eating, when lying down to sleep, he knows just that. this, the word for that, which they use, the Pali word is sampajanya, which we translate sometimes as clear comprehension. Clearly comprehending, what am I doing? We talk about a day of mindfulness. Mindfulness, usually the word is sati in Pali. And two terms are often hyphenated. They come together. Sati, sampajanya. Mindfulness and clear comprehension. Mindfulness, the quality of paying attention, clear comprehension. What is this my domain? What am I paying attention to? What am I doing in terms of action? So when you do this, you realize that a lot of this is the beginning of the approach to reality. This little exercise has to be the foundation, and this is what is called the four foundations of mindfulness, a foundation, an anchor, which you can make an entrance to direct reality. If you don't cultivate this practice and get in touch again and again, what does it feel like to be here? What do I actually do during the day? What do you do during the day? When the Buddha, he gives a thumbnail summary of just about everything that a person really does. You find out that all you do is stretch your arm out, you bring it back, you stand up, you walk, you turn around, you look, you sit down, you drink, you eat, you lie down, you go to sleep. This is what you actually do during the day. There seems to be a cloud of complexity around life. What is that cloud of complexity? That is concept and proliferation. A beautiful word in Pali. They know this is from the Buddhist point of view. It's called papancha. The proliferation of thoughts. In a sense, it's building castles in the air. Complex castles built in clouds. And that is what we, in a sense, that cloud, you remember that song by Joni Mitchell, Clouds? She's observing, we do this all the time, especially as kids. We do it more as adults, actually. Is just look at the cloud formations and you see castles and you see all this. What are you doing there? You're projecting onto these. These are not any particular thing, but you're pulling them. You're pulling things out, concepts, overlaying conscious structures on random patterns. We have to realize this is a very good exercise to do. To realize that is what we are doing constantly in ordinary reality. We're overlaying patterns and textures on reality, and these are concepts. So, and that they're perfectly fine. The joy of cloud watching is well known. But if you forget that you're cloud watching, if you now when that cloud breaks up, that was a very beautiful castle. Do you weep? Kids have the right idea. It's the same with going down to the beach, making the sand castles. One of the built right into the sand castle. Thing. And that's probably a good idea to occasionally do as an adult, to just go down and just, what is the difference between building a sandcastle? You know it's going to go at the end of the day. Interestingly, kids having worked laboriously on these things and making elaborate things and being very concerned at the time, at the end of it all, I mean, you got to go, right? And then there's the joy of sort of kicking it apart. You know, well, it's going to go anyway. It's not a bad part of the process. It's one of the joyful parts of the process, the dissolution of these things. You know that you watch the Tibetans tour around North America making sandcastles, of the universe, the whole universe. They make a mandala out of sand. That is a sandcastle. Exactly what kids do on the beach. We make, what's so interesting about it is it's made out of sand, which is like little, the smallest elements, the solid little elements of earth and space. And you construct it in a very detailed way with great precision and great artistry. And at the end, what do they do? wipe it all up, throw it in the river. Exactly. This mandala, Zen mandala thing, is ancient observation by philosophers from all traditions, including the Buddhist philosophers, is that we don't have a problem with it when we're at play, you know, when children are making, because, you know, 2,500 years ago, that's exactly what kids did too. They, as soon as you get to the bank of the river and out in the sand and everything, you make things like that. But you don't. The joy of creativity is there. But then when it falls away, it's fine. There's no problem. And that is two things that they're teaching you with us, this making a mandala of the universe. Is one, this is the nature of the universe. First, it's made out of, it's not, you notice that you see patterns in the sand, eh? The patterns aren't there, there's just sand. What can you, if the pattern's there, you should pick it up. Huh? You can't pick up the pattern. You're overlaying this pattern. Your consciousness is organizing this pattern. Have you ever noticed that, like, this is a typical in art, that there are the little pattern where you have two images, and like there's the famous one where you can see it as a cup, or you see it as two people about to kiss, the outline of two faces like that. Now, some people perceive the cup, other people perceive the two outline of the face, and then once it's pointed out that you can see it as a cup, then you start switching back and forth between the two perceptions. You begin to realize that there isn't a cup there, and there isn't faces there. It's however you are organizing structures. This is the same with the stars. What do you call this? Big Dipper and so forth. Constellations. Yeah, constellations. This is, what is that? These are randomly sprinkled objects in the sky. There's little diamonds hanging in the sky. And you see the Big Dipper. You see Orion. Are they there? Or is it just randomly scattered particles? Do you see a line of... Is there really a line of five stars in a row? Is that a line? Why do you say it's... Why are they in a row? What makes you think they're in a row? Why don't you say that this one is by itself and the other four are in a row? The outer two are have a relationship with each other, or maybe the middle one and the end one and the beginning one. And the other two, why do you think they relate? Maybe they relate to something else. These are just random. What consciousness does this, organizes. Interestingly, this is our human community is based on this, and that is why you are accepted into a community, or you feel comfortable, because you are familiar with the organizational patterns, what they decide. So certain, of course, you go to different cultures, they have different constellations. They didn't organize it the same way. Same with this. So we realize that it's really interesting. It's not that everybody doesn't see a different thing in the sky. Many people see similar structures, and the same in culture and so forth. It tells us who we are, that the essence of mind, this is one of the essences of mind. And it tells you that mind itself is a universal thing, organizes, I can talk to you about this thing and you understand what I'm saying, that you know, sometimes you perceive it this way, sometimes you perceive it that way. And I do too. This tells us that there's nothing personal about it. That this is just a universal thing that consciousness does. So this is all kind of interesting psychological stuff, but what does it mean from what does the Buddha use this things for? One is to depersonalize the idea of mind so that you lose your sense of identity. He says, it's not you doing this. You're not the one who organizes this. You don't know how consciousness is made. All we do is observe that this happens in consciousness. This helps when you do this, it helps to depersonalize or de-identify yourself. What is the root of all problems? From the Buddhist analysis, the root of all problems is identity, a self. And what goes along with identity? Ownership and control. Why is it that at the end of the day, kids kick apart the sandcastle and have a good time? They don't cry. It's fine. They were fully aware of a couple things. One, they're only there for the afternoon. They only got a few hours. This is clear to them. They don't forget that. Secondly, it's not... the sand is valueless in terms of any... You can just go and pick up any sand. There is no ownership over this stuff. And at the end of the day, it returns to sand. It was sand to begin with, it was sand in the end. The little structures of the castles are just artificial. Because they have this, it's clear to them. They have no problem. It's just when you forget that you have a problem, you create ownership, control, and you want things to last. So this is resistance to reality, resistance to the impermanence of things. Sense of ownership, and that is what comes with identity. Identity, you know, the Buddhist term, anatta, self and not self. These very roots of the problems of reality, of ordinary life, are about forgetting that there is no you. There is no identity. It's a concept. It's not the direct experience. What is the direct experience? Touch of the carpet on your feet. The experience of the water. The coolness of the water as it goes into the mouth. The cleanness of it. The smell of the flowers. Or the humidity in the room. This is reality, but where's the owner? Where's me in there? If you want to add a me, then you say, you start to think, my experience, you know, you start to fantasize about a me and my opinions and my judgments about this experience. But what is there directly? That's an overlay. What is there directly? The experience, the direct experience of the elements of reality. So this is a very more direct kind of experience than the subtleties of breath meditation. When you pay attention to the ordinary, this is the very ordinary experiences of life. Now we tend to dismiss this. We're looking for the extraordinary. We're waiting for like all day we're waiting for supper. Or, you know, we're going out to dinner tonight. And that is all of the day is geared towards that. Or there's a good movie on TV tonight, and you keep thinking, you know, that's going to be the reward of the day. So in ordinary experience, after childhood, we start to ignore the ordinary. In childhood, you notice that they're right, as soon as you drop them into a room, they're right down on those rock. Did you notice that rock? You know, I never noticed that, but that's just like, it's round. You know, wow, that one's round. But look at that one. It's got a curve in it. You know, they're right into it. They're right there all the time. Somehow, we start to be pulled away from this experience. And that's when life becomes problematic. We just want to hit the high points. And we tend to shut down except for the high points. And that, how many high points are there in life? Probably, you know, 2% of your experience of life is high points. If you're ignoring 98% of your life, devaluing it, leaving it out of the experience, leaving interest out of that, well, you're just wasting a huge proportion of your life. What is it that makes life interesting? It's a good question. I won't answer this. What is it that makes life interesting? Anybody know? Yeah, that's an interesting reply. It's very personal. What is it that makes life interesting? Yeah, it could be. I want a better answer than that, because what is it that makes life interesting? I want something that works in 100% of all cases. Obstacles, you know, I mean, so life isn't interesting when you don't have obstacles. Huh? When you're having a really good time, it's not interesting? Huh? Some people might say, well, you got to have obstacles in order to enjoy the non-obstacle time, etc. I want an answer. I want a Buddha answer. What would the Buddha say that makes life interesting? Huh? You're getting very close. Very close. I would say it's even closer. Huh? Yes, you're homing in on it. I think the Buddha, you know, you read these suttas and you think, it's so perplexing. Now when he tells you the answer, it's just so obvious. Huh? Close. I would call it interest. That's what makes, no? What makes life interesting? Interest. Yeah, you're in. That could be the object of your interest, but it's interest itself that makes life interesting. Nothing else. That tends to be so obvious, so close to us, that we overlook it. What is it about an experience that makes it interesting? It's you're interested in it. That's what makes it interesting. Interest is another word for attention. It's another word for mindfulness. It's another word for clear comprehension. It's another word for concentration. It's another word for serenity. It's another word for presence. Here's another word for being there. So, all of the Buddhist exercises are around this. You know, the Buddha's, you know, if you tell people what you did today, I went to church for 8 hours. You know, wow, it sounds boring. What'd you do? Well, we sat there. I noticed I was breathing. And then we walked around in a rather kind of chaotic fashion. By the way, when we got up to walk, did you notice that? But we were all kind of confused, and it was not orderly and everything. Did you find that imperfect? Yeah. That was perfect. That was perfect. That should it have been some other way? We couldn't decide whether to make one line and then where do we go, and then we decided to do two lines, and then people went through the same, then they mixed the lines together, and then we changed it, and then we moved the curve. Now should it have been some other way? Right. Could it have been some other way? That's a better way of saying. Could it have been some other way?
If we had organized beforehand. But we didn't know what the situation was.
But we didn't. Ah, because it couldn't have been because we didn't organize it another way. So it couldn't have been any other way. And therefore it shouldn't have been any other way. And therefore it was perfect. It was the way it should be. What we notice, what should we notice about those kind of things is separation from it. Is thinking we should have organized this in order. We should have, would have, could have. And that is the imposition of a theoretical structure in reality, or that is the belief. That's when you actually feel it. Now, it's all right, you know, that we have these theoretical structures. They're actually regards the future, not the present. Should, would, could is perfectly legitimate, but only involves the future, not the present, and certainly not the past. It's a useful concept, but you notice another concept, the future. The future doesn't exist. It's one of the things the Buddha says. The future doesn't exist. It's very nice, very relieved to know that. It's a great relief, isn't it? All the terrible things that happen in the future. Thank goodness it doesn't exist, you know. It's really nice. So he's saying, you know, it's all right. These concepts are about this thing that doesn't exist, called your imagination. All that really exists is your imagination, manipulations of mind, and so forth. And so, isn't it a relief that we don't have to actually worry about it? You know, we can rearrange the patterns, so which we call the future, but there's no concern for, it's not real, so it can't hurt us. There is no danger in the future? That sounds wrong, doesn't it? There is no danger in the future. The future doesn't exist, can't hurt you. Right? Where is the danger? If there is a danger, where is it? In the present. You know, it's the only place that anything can ever be a problem or a danger to you is the present. These element meditations, now this is you will find, say, in your ordinary experience, have you found that, and there you have your favorite kind, there are certain things you want to do. Maybe when you feel a little stressed, you like to go to the river, walk along the canal. You like to just get outside, especially in the fall, maybe. Some people like to get, especially on like a rainy day, get an umbrella or a rain cape or something like that and go for a walk in it. Somehow, or maybe instead, now maybe that's something you're thinking, I don't really like to walk in the rain. How about you ever relax in the shower? Do you exclusively take baths and showers for the sole purpose of cleansing the body? Is there nothing else to that experience? What is that experience? That is the experience of the element of water. You get in the shower and close your eyes and take a deep breath and let the problems of the world go. And stand there and go, and you feel, and what happens perhaps, you may notice, now pay attention next time, if you're doing breath meditation, is that you take one deep breath and sigh. And for about 3 or 4 seconds at least, there's nothing else in the world but the warmth. Two elements, warmth and the liquid element. And what has that done? What have you done for those 5 or 10 seconds there? Have you sort of indulged yourself, being an irresponsible mother, an irresponsible businessman, forgetting about his worries for a little while? What? No, what you've done there is really meditated on the elements. And this is what Buddha is saying, you know, why don't you do that more often? It's very helpful. You will do better business that way. You will be a better mother. You will, if you do these things, somehow we can pull it off when we think we're not meditating. It's like many experiences when you ask the person to do it, they can't. But it's when they're not self-conscious, not aware, when they just indulge in it, let themselves go into it, they do it. Now this is the serenity aspect of elements. And this is when you sit down and do breath meditation, it's the same thing. Just think about what it feels like when you get in the shower. The same when you sit down to do breath meditation. Just think, taking a breather. You know, this is so many phrases in the English language that gives us clues to what meditation is. Even like water, chilling out. This is cooling off. So one of the descriptions of nirvana is the cool, is the chill. And of course, nirvana is, this particular description is from northern India, where it's like, it is 140 degrees in the hot season. And the idea of paradise tends to be cool. There's always trees in heaven. The final, ultimate relief from suffering is cool. Now in Canada, maybe it's warm. No, but warm up, So we have to pay more attention to these natural experiences where we do meditate, when we just let go and experience the elements, let go of the conceptualized. It's not dangerous at all. That tendency to organize and think and proliferate is... Do you ever notice that you didn't just start doing that, or that you taught yourself to do that? That is built in. It is not you that does it. It is, it's called consciousness, not your consciousness. It is called consciousness. It is called thinking, not your thoughts. It is called thinking. It is an impersonal, universal process which functions by laws that are too deep for us to even know. It happens by itself. How do you come up with solutions? How do you solve problems? How do you remember somebody's name? Anybody know? You don't know. It just appears pink like that. Is there any point in worrying about it? Taking responsibility for it? No. It's very, very good to be able to let go of that process and to just take a deep sigh and breathe. To enjoy the sound of the rain. That's another, one of the element meditations. The sound of water. Very nice. The sight of water. The feel of the earth. The sight of the grass. The sight of the trees. What is the tree? The sight of the trees is the sight of solidity. It's a nice mixture of elements. Solidity and space, especially when the wind blows through them. At that point, you're seeing the sight of the wind element. This is an actual meditation subject. If you read the old commentaries, you will see that people at the time of the Buddha say, and afterwards, some people, if they were so inclined, they attained jhana, deep, profound samadhi, the ecstasy of saints, by watching the wind blow through the trees. By listening to the rain, by sitting by a river, watching the water flow, by putting their hands in the water, by one of the beautiful ones is by seeing a rose, a red rose. It was the color red. The person got a rose and was so absorbed. They found such peace descending upon them just by its redness. They enter jhana. The sun comes out from behind the clouds. This yellow light, beautiful kind of yellow cheering light, and the feel of the warmth. People have entered serenity on this. The Buddha is advocating, this is a blameless abiding, profitable, far more profitable than almost any of your other activities, is to simply allow peace and entering the present and to the appreciation of interest, to allow your interest to be there in the simplest things, like the color of a rose, the feel of the breeze against your skin, the sound of the water falling out of the sky, just the walking across the carpet, the presence, to be there, to breathe, to just allow, to be interested in the fact that you're breathing. It makes it interesting. It makes life interesting. So this is covering all of these topics of meditation, and really that is what it comes down to. If you, I was thinking to myself the other day this morning that it's kind of true that maybe you should tell people that if they keep meditating, they're going to have some real problems. This is what you should tell your friends. If you keep meditating, you'll have some real problems. What kind of problems do you want? If you give up meditating, or you don't meditate, you know what kind of problems you'll have? Unreal problems. That is exactly what the unmeditated mind has. It's full of unreal problems. So at least meditation, you get to have, deal with real problems. This is the attempt, the Buddha is saying, look, you know, you've got to get, let's start sorting it out. What are unreal problems? What are real problems? Most of your problems are unreal. How are you going to find that out? They're all conceptual proliferations, endless discursive fantasizing, etc. How are you going to get out of that? Get in touch with reality. Be here. Feel the air. Know what you do. When you walk across the room, know that's all you're doing. You're not having a melodrama. You're walking across the room. It is... If we're going to have any problems at all, at least let's have some real problems. And actually, if you do this, you'll find out there aren't very many problems. What we actually do is quite simple. Life is quite simple. It's designed that way. But you can't know it until you practice this way and you come back to the experience of knowing what's real and what's a concept. What's the present and what's the imaginary future and what's the imaginary past. And this is where things start to dissolve on their own. That is where the unreality, the problems are not solved. Most problems are not solved, they're dissolved. And not by thinking about them. By teaching yourself the use of thought and the misuse of thought. And how do you do that? You just want again and again and again. You bring your attention back here. You pay attention. You bring up interest. What's going on now? What is this now? If you do this, you will start to, without any particular volition on your part, you will start to notice that you're starting to pick up a habit. Your mind is habitually, because you've been asking it to do it again and again and again, starting without no surprise, it's starting to a kind of a thing that you can't know from your own personal experience. All you have to do is look at your own life and look at your habits, things that you are that have habit energy. And there's two types: one unskillful, and the other one skillful. In other words, good habits and bad habits. But notice the power of habit, how it has a life of its own. It takes on a life of its own. And so all you got to know is that how does it occur? It by repetition. And so all you got to do is harness this. This is one of the things that the mind does. Harness this in your favor, and it will take on a life of its own. This practice of being here, in touch with the elements. Breath meditation is the elements. Walking meditation are the elements. There is a practice of the being here, there's a practice of interest, there's a practice of simplicity, it is a practice of dissolving problems. And if you do this again and again as an exercise, it will start to take on a life of its own. And it will become a way of life. And it will have a lot of power, in fact. Even if you stop doing it, it will have a life energy. It will last a long time, even lifetimes. Not just one life energy. You notice that people, even tiny kids, have tendencies, personality structures. They have this, they're very different. Mothers see this even when they're 6 months old. They're very different. They're coming in with personality tendencies. Deeply formulated tendencies, predispositions. These are habit energies that are lasting lifetimes. What you're doing now won't be lost. But you got to remember, what you're doing now won't be lost. In other words, so when you don't stay here in contact with reality, if you're wandering and imagining, that won't be lost either. So It's being careful, frugal in a sense, and concerned with which jar you're dropping things into: the unskillful, the wandering, the anxious, the attachment, the belief in the reality of the future and the past, or in the other jar, where reality is here and now, directly. This is where you deal with it. The place where you have real problems that you solve, or into the jar where you have unreal problems that you never solve. But this is the context of meditation in general. I'll leave this little talk on meditation for now. I'll continue some reflections perhaps in the afternoon on this, and you may have, by then you may have some questions also about what I've said, and we will take some time now for just stretching your legs and knowing that you're walking across the room, and when you turn around, knowing you're turning around, etc. And when you eat, knowing that you're eating. Things like this. So the meal coming up and everything is also a practice. It's a very good opportunity for practicing reality, the experience of the elements. All that the Buddha asks is, nothing wrong with this, we're not going to stop eating. This is not outside of meditation, this is part of life, and all of life is a meditation. But make it interesting. At least pay attention. So I will leave those marks for your reflection.